I'd like to begin by introducing myself. There are some people here new to the organization, so I'll spend just a couple brief moments speaking about what the JSN is. The Jewish Study Network is a Jewish educational organization that officially is dedicated, the official mission statement is dedicated to raising the level of Jewish literacy in the Bay Area. And the way we do that is we spend time studying the Talmud and other Jewish traditional sources, as well as we prepare classes and then, of course, teach those classes really all over the Bay. So we now have a center in San Francisco, and the people who work and live up there, they teach all the way down to Foster City and up, and then we have people in San Jose, Sunnyvale, and, of course, here in Palo Alto. It's so what that means, what that basically translates into is about 40 classes a week or so that we're teaching. And then every once in a while we have a class that is a one-time class such as this, which may or may not spawn itself into a series of classes depending on the interest level of the people that are coming. Sometimes we will, let's say, teach one class about prayer, and then people, four or five people, want to learn really much more in depth about prayer, so we'll get together and we'll start a class just on that subject. Okay, so who am I? My name is Rabbi Avi Stewart. I am, of course, a rabbi here in Palo Alto with this organization, the Jewish Study Network, and I received my ordination from Baltimore. There's a yeshiva in Baltimore called Ner Yisrael, or Ner Israel Rabbinical College, which you may have heard of, and I studied there for about 10 years, give or take. I spent 2.5 years in Israel somewhere during that 10 years, and then I've been here for 3 years as well. While I was in Baltimore, I also spent time at Johns Hopkins University getting a master's in counseling. So I do some of that as well on the side. And I often like to teach, some of you here have heard me teach before, I often like to teach about those two worlds and how we, how they merge or sometimes don't. But usually there's a lot of common ground between the world of therapy and the world of Torah. So the class tonight is called The Art of Love. It should have been called The Art of Loving. I just misremembered the name of the book by Eric Fromm called The Art of Loving, which is a phenomenal book, an excellent book, and I recommend the reading of it. Anything he says in here about Torah, I strongly encourage you to ignore. Because it's just not, it's an opinion, but I'm not presenting this as my opinion. However, that's really minor compared to the grand scheme of things in terms of what he's really out to accomplish, which is to talk about love in today's world. Now, although he wrote this in 1956, it's more true today than it ever was in terms of the ideas that he talks about in a way, the difficulties that people have with love. Before we get, and then there's a second resource, which we'll get to in a moment, but really before beginning my talk, because I'm really prepared to talk for a few hours, which we won't do, because no one really wants to sit for a few hours. I mentioned the class has been advertised as The Art of Love. So I really want to hear from you, what does that mean to you, and why did you come, and what do you hope to get out of this class? And hopefully we shall meet somewhere, and that which I have prepared is relevant, I'm sure will be relevant, to some element and topic about love. So if anybody has anything that they say, you know, I'm curious, what were you expecting to hear about? Because love is, I was talking to Meryl, mm-hmm. Before, it's such an ambiguous title, The Art of Love. Well, what does that mean exactly? So if there's something specific that you were hoping to hear about, I would love to make sure that I do that. And so please feel free to share. Alternatively, everybody just came because the flyer looked nice and you just wanted to try it out.
I guess I came with an expectation to hear about the Jewish tradition and philosophies around love.
Okay.
That's what I'm assuming I would hear about. So okay. That's my expectation now.
And I think you're right. Like any other shiur that you would attend, shiur is Hebrew for class. So like any other class that you would come to at the JSN, what you're more or less guaranteed to hear is what we have to offer, which is Torah. Torah, of course, is the five books of Moses, Chamisha Chumshei Torah, what the Christians call the Old Testament. But in addition to that, it's also the Talmud and the Oral Law, which accompany and explain and elaborate and elucidate the written law. Torah is the traditional Jewish way of looking at life, and this is really simply because the Torah guides us through every single facet of our lives. You know, I once had an argument with a college professor of mine about spirituality and religion. And as far as he was concerned, they're just two separate realms. You can be spiritual or you can be religious. Why? Because for him, religion meant ritual. It meant going to church and going through various rituals, and that is what the religion demands of the person. Spirituality is something that a person can attain regardless of what religion they have, regardless of what rituals they may be observing as part of their religion, and it's something that is something between him and, or she and, God. Now, there's plenty of chairs, please come on in. Pardon me? Yes. Are there more outlines? I hope so. There's a couple more on the table. Right there? Okay. Okay. I made 15 copies. If worst comes to worst, or best comes to best, I can go out and make a couple more. Okay. Anyways, as I was saying, in his world, spirituality and religion are two separate realms of service, if you will. In Judaism, that is not correct. That is not true. When the bracha that we make when performing any mitzvah is Asher kiddushanu b'mitzvotav etzivanu, God who has sanctified and made us holy through his mitzvot. It is through the mitzvot that we can attain spirituality. That is not to say that one cannot attain spirituality outside of mitzvot, but the Torah is the framework by which we lead a spiritual life. That is point number one. Point number two is that Judaism really infuses every aspect, every element of life, as opposed to it being something only in the shul, only in the synagogue, or only in the church. Judaism has what to say, the Torah has what to say about every single element of a person's life, whether it is from the way they construct their house, to the way they conduct business, to how marriages and divorces are meant to be performed. Does this sound, this sounds more or less familiar, I imagine. Okay. And as such, when we come to a class here at the Jewish Study Network, what we have to offer and what we have to share is the Torah's viewpoint of these elements. Okay, so I believe that Roger is correct, and you're going to hear the Torah's philosophy on love. But it's still very vague. It's still very vague, and yes, I'll make sure to meet those expectations. Okay, so the question, not everybody was in the room at the time, but the question I asked was, by coming here tonight, what are you expecting to hear, or what are you hoping to hear that you may, because the title for the class is really ambiguous, The Art of Love. So if anybody has anything that they want to ask, or mention, or bring up, please feel free to do so at any point in time. And I don't like lecturing. I mean, I do like lecturing, but I don't like lecturing to people who are not participating. So I invite you and I encourage you and I welcome you to ask questions, to comment, to join the discussion so that it isn't just one directional. Okay.
I have two questions. So the first one is evolution of the love. Because in the past time, there was not much focus on love. Mm-hmm. And people were getting married not for love, just for different reasons. And love was not the main topic in that life. This century is everything is about love.
Sure.
Interesting to know how it was in the past and how much significance of this love and saying I love you every day, did they do the same not, or
okay,
or just love meant just by doing good deeds and mitzvahs.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, yeah.
Good points. So we're going to get to those. We're going to talk about both of those points. Okay. when thinking about the topic of love, so I came up with 12 or 13 questions that would be relevant and interesting, and really we can spend one class talking about each one of those questions, which we're not going to do. Just to give you an example, I teach a class on Tuesday nights in Cupertino, and it wasn't exactly a dry run, but I was still formulating my thoughts about how exactly I want to present the class for tonight. So we went around the room and we asked, you know, what questions do you have come to mind about love? And they asked about three or four questions, and we talked about two of them in about an hour and a half. Okay, because it's just the nature of the Torah is so rich, and as Roger was saying earlier, the Jewish philosophy, which is driven by Torah, is so deep and so rich and so broad at the same time. There's always a lot to talk about, particularly when you get a group of people together who enjoy talking. It's no surprise that it can go on and on. Okay, but our goal for this evening is to be out of here by 8:45 at the latest. If you choose to stay beyond that, it's your free choice that's in operation at that time, and I'm happy to stay as long as you like. Okay. Let's begin by asking two really close-ended questions. Does the Torah command us to love?
Yeah.
I heard two different answers.
Yes, the Torah.
The Torah demands it.
Yeah.
Okay, what do you...
Hashem, and to love the human being, and to have love in the Shema. Shema.
Okay, good. It's yeah.
The Shema says to love.
The Shema says to love, okay.
But there's other areas where it doesn't say to love. It says other words instead.
Okay.
Like the first commandment doesn't say to love.
The first one being be fruitful and multiply?
No, the first commandment of the Ten Commandments.
Oh. Well, there's 613 commandments, so...
Of the ten.
My question is, does the Torah, in terms of the five books, all five books, does the Torah command us to love? And the answer is, somewhere in there?
Somewhere, yes.
Yes, okay. Was there any other no? If anyone wants to elaborate on that, no, that's yes.
It's a double-edged sword, since we're commanded to love, and if you don't love, you're going to get whammied over the head. You don't get your rain, you don't get your crops, and enemies will come and swoop right behind mm-hmm. you. You know, so there's a love and there's an anti-love. You have to love.
Okay, so when talking about what kind of love are you talking about? If you don't love your fellow person...
Well, I was referring to the Shema.
Okay, referring to the Shema. Okay, good. So the answer to the question is yes. Like I said, it's a closed-ended question. But even in Judaism, when you have a closed-ended question, instead of saying a yes or no, we can talk about it and maybe answer a question with another question. Do you remember, who was that famous... there was an Israeli prime minister? Someone help me out here. Who was having a dialogue with one of the American presidents, and I don't remember who it was exactly, but it doesn't matter, it could have been any one of them, where the president says, I don't understand, like, what's the big deal? Why can't you govern your country more effectively? You only have about, you know, 10 million people. I have 200 million people, whatever number it was at the time in the United States. And he says, you might have 200 million subjects or people, you know, who vote, but I have 10 million prime ministers. Okay. So the second close-ended question is, who are we commanded to love? So far I heard two out of three answers. I heard other people, and I heard God. It's a mitzvah to love God, as we say in the Shema. V'yohavta et Hashem Elokecha b'chol levavecha. Is it a mitzvah to love God?
Yourself.
To love life?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there is a mitzvah not to commit suicide, right? It's actually forbidden to commit suicide.
Is there anything stronger than that?
There is a mitzvah to promote your own life, meaning if you have a choice between your life and someone else's life, so...
You have to love yourself. So it says love your neighbor as yourself. So
that's
your commandments, to love your neighbor.
It's implied that you're meant to love yourself, okay. And one of the questions people often ask is, well, what if you don't love yourself?
Yeah.
Okay. So good. So far we've got other people, we've got God, we've got yourself, and we have...
Because if I assume that you love yourself, then you love your neighbor. But if you don't assume that, then the whole thing.
Right.
How can you be commanded to have a feeling?
Excellent question.
To be commanded to perform an action or
yes.
to refrain from certain actions? But how can you be commanded to feel something?
Okay, excellent question. I love that segue because it's more or less what we're going to go into. And that's a question that can be asked about any sort of love. There is, by the way, one additional element of love that the Torah says that has not yet been said, and that is v'ahavtem es hager. That is that one should love a convert, a ger tzedek, somebody who has converted to Judaism from non-Judaism. There's a special commandment to love that person that's different somehow or another than loving other people. In terms of whether or not there's a mitzvah to love your spouse beyond the love for other people, so the Gemara does record a commandment like that, but it's not explicit in the Torah itself. But if you study the Parsha in the beginning of Bereishit, the beginning of Genesis, where Adam and Eve are relating to each other for the first time, there's a lot we can learn about the love between spouses from that Parsha. But in terms of an actual commandment that you shall love your wife, well, your wife is no different than, or your husband, is no different than any other person. So if you have to love Yahshua Kamocho, it would be all-inclusive. Okay.
Question?
Yeah. Please just tell me your name, because I'm
Ilya.
Ilya?
Yeah. Let's say that the God loves children, like
yes.
humans, and so, and then that parallels to relationship between us and God and the parents and children.
Mm-hmm.
And that means, in some sense, that there's implied love between parents and children, or from the parents.
Yes.
It's not a commandment, really. It's more like
it's a reality.
As a
reality.
Yeah.
Okay. By the way, any questions about and every I don't know most of you in the room, but if a child has a parent who is like, you ever read The Child Called It? I don't recommend it. It's very frightening. The Child Called It. It's a series of books written by a person that recovered from being a child that was really neglected by his parents. Right? Those are the exceptions to the rule. We're not talking about exceptions to the rule. We're talking in generalities about usual circumstances. So sometimes people say, well, am I commanded to love my parents or respect my parents if they abuse me and if they neglected me and questions like that? Those are the exceptions to the rule. Okay, but what I really want to talk about, and I think we'll be able to meet... tell me your name one more time.
Mike?
Yeah.
Eugenia,
as well as Roger's comments in terms of the expectations coming in here. I really want to talk about the three biggest challenges. We definitely will talk about the first two. We'll see if we have time for the third. We'll definitely answer it in shorthand form, but in whether or not we have time to elaborate on, we'll see. Talk about the three biggest challenges for each area of love of God. If you notice on your handout, it says there's three basic areas of love. There's fellow man, and of course that just means humanity, God, and spouse. So we're not going to go in that order. We're going to go with Reyacha, which is a fellow person, and then we're going to continue with loving your spouse. We're going to talk about the biggest challenges that we face today, and you're touching on some of them in your comments, and then we're going to hopefully... by understanding the Torah's philosophy or the Torah's understanding of what love is, hopefully be able to deal with those challenges in a fairly effective way. Okay.
So
let's talk about love of your fellow person. What do you think is the biggest challenge in loving other people? What might be the biggest challenge, or one of the bigger challenges, in loving other people? You may not like them, it's true. Let's start with the first mitzvah. Let's just start with the wording of the mitzvah. The mitzvah is v'ahavta l're'acha kamocha, which means then you shall love your fellow as much as you love yourself. So what might be the biggest challenge in loving... Cindy?
Well, people in general tend to be able to disconnect from people they don't know. If they hear of tragedies and things that happen around the world, if it's not someone they know, then they're able to compartmentalize it and not take it too seriously.
Okay.
And then they feel more attachment to people they know really closely.
Okay, so you're gonna. So the challenge, simply stated, is if to someone I don't know, so then how can I love them?
It's. I just think it's kind of hard for human nature, the way we're wired to feel a strong emotion like love for people we don't know.
Okay.
It's a biology.
You don't want to be bothered by those people because you don't know them.
Mm-hmm. Kaylee, you said good.
I agree with what Roger said just a few minutes ago. You don't even like them. How are you supposed to love them?
Okay.
You know, I mean, you're my competitor. What do I have to like about you?
Okay.
I want to be better than you.
I think it's most of our lives we think about ourselves, you know, most of the day, like what am I going to do, and how is this going to affect me, how is that. And I think you put that aside, discuss.
Putting ourselves aside, excellent.
Just like an extension of that, you can come from a place of love. But if the other person doesn't receive it, or they have very negative being, you can't do with it. You can feel love for everything, but you have to have a place to put it.
Okay. I'll just to add to that, has anyone here ever given a gift? Everyone here has given a gift at some point in their lives. Okay. Have you ever given a gift that you wanted to give the person as opposed to the person needed to get?
Yeah.
We've all done that.
Yeah.
So that's kind of, it's a bit of an extension of what you're saying, I think. And not to take away from what you're saying, but just to add on to what you're saying. Really, when we talk about gift giving or helping people out, you know, it's like the story of the fellow who went to visit his friend in the hospital. And he drove, you know, a couple hours to get to the hospital. When he got there, the patient was sleeping. So what did he do?
He turned around and go home.
That would have been the right thing to do. But he tripped over the chair, you know, he fiddled with the drapes, and by mistake, on purpose, accidentally woke the patient up. Okay? Why? Because who was the mitzvah for? Was it for the person that was quote-unquote giving? The person that was visiting the sick person? Obviously not. But we all know either ourselves that have done something like that at some point in our lives, or we know somebody that has maybe done that to us at some point in our lives, and obviously you don't have to be sick or visiting the sick for this example, but if that's one of the challenges. The challenge is in meeting the needs of the person as opposed to meeting your own needs.
It's not a fair example.
Pardon me?
It's not a fair example.
Why is it not a fair example?
Why? Because if I was sick and a friend of mine came to visit me and I had no idea about it, you know.
So you might be upset.
Of course. I'd
okay.
I want to see the person.
Yeah. So obviously, for you, that example is not effective. But what if it's the person that you didn't know very well and it's quote-unquote, maybe it's the same person that you didn't like, that you just asked about, what would be then?
I mean, I may be visiting them. They might not believe me. I won't be the point.
Okay. I think the point that we have here is that it's possible to do a mitzvah for yourself as opposed to do a mitzvah for the person for whom you're doing it. Does that make sense? Okay, that's all I'm trying to bring up. Yes. Okay, last point and then challenge.
The other thing is the commandment is conditional. If you're supposed to love your fellow humans as you love yourself, that predicates that you love yourself.
Yes.
Well, does that mean you're off the hook if you don't love yourself?
Good question. Okay, what if you don't love yourself, right?
Well, they say you can't love anyone if you don't love yourself.
I think that's a truism, but here I'm back to the commandment aspect of it, in which it's not about what you naturally feel, and yet it is. And there's a problem with that.
Is there a possibility that when Hashem dictated the Torah, the word love had a different connotation than the way we use it now, so we're confused because we're taking a very modern concept of the word love compared to the word in the Torah.
I think
even the translation, I mean, we certainly found that words just don't translate. There isn't an equivalent.
Right, so the first thing we have to do, it's not the first thing we're going to do, but we will get to it, is really define love from the Torah's perspective. Once we define love from the Torah's perspective, a lot of these questions will kind of fall by the wayside. Okay.
A lot of different words for love in Hebrew.
In modern Hebrew or in biblical Hebrew?
Both.
Okay.
Ahava, ahava, kebah.
Yeah.
Kendah.
So which is the one?
We're going to work. We're working with Ahava specifically. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. To me, a question that wasn't asked, and it's asked by Fromm in his book called The Art of Loving. I mentioned it earlier. If you haven't read it, he wrote it in 1956, but it's really a worthwhile read. And to me, one of the questions that he asks, or he talks about, and it's asked by Jewish sources as well, by traditional Jewish sources as well, is that there seems to be a conflict here. If I love myself, and again, it's implied that you do love yourself, right? So if you do love yourself, doesn't that mean that that takes away from your love for other people? So he writes that loving oneself, and this, we're going to start talking about the definition, but we're going to hone it down sooner rather than later. Loving oneself is quite different from being arrogant, conceited, or egocentric. Loving oneself means caring about oneself, taking responsibility for oneself, respecting oneself, and knowing oneself. In other words, being realistic and honest about one's strengths and weaknesses. And in order to be, he writes that in order to be able to truly love any other person, one needs to first to love one's own self in this way. Okay, so that's kind of, it begins an understanding of what we're talking about in terms of at least understanding who we're talking about exactly. Okay. But I agree. It does demand, we are agreeing that in order to love other people properly, the first thing you have to do is have a degree of self-love. Now, just almost a cute idea that somebody answers this question with, a very, very simple idea, and even if you just remember this from the class, it's maybe worth walking away with, and that is, okay, what if I don't love myself? Okay, well, that's ridiculous, because I do love myself. I mean, outside of a really, you know, suicidal person who wants to stop living, okay? What's the proof that I really love myself? The answer is that I'm easier on myself than I am on other people. I'm more forgiving of myself than I am of other people. So the mitzvah for that sort of person, it's called, the Yiddish word, really it's Hebrew, but it's become Yiddish, is vatranus or vatranut, to be mivater, which means not to be makbid, not to be so strict, you know, on other people. In other words, you might say, well, no, I am very hard on myself. I have low self-esteem. I don't believe in myself, so I don't believe in other people either. No. But there's things that you do that you take it easy upon yourself. What might be an example of that? I don't know. You cut somebody off while driving. You get angry or you're impatient with somebody. You don't have expectations of yourself that would make it hard for you to live with yourself in those areas. So for that type of a person, you can say that the mitzvah is v'ahavta l'recha kamocha, which means be mevater, don't be makbid, be as easygoing with other people as you are with yourself. And that, you know, so you say, oh, I hate myself. Well, it's not so simple. There are areas of your life where you are rather easy on yourself, and if you can be as easy on other people as you are on yourself, then that would be a fulfillment of the mitzvah of v'ahavta l'recha kamocha, loving other people as much as you love yourself, for that sort of person. Obviously, that's not a we're not talking about the ideal, but that's an interesting idea. Yeah.
Also, what comes to my mind when I think of love others as you love yourself has to do with, okay, say you're really in a hurry and you want to get to where you're supposed to be going in your hustle and bustle life, and then you notice there's someone who needs some help. If you are really to love them as you love yourself, you will, you know, take the time to do whatever to help them with something they need and make yourself late. You know, and make an inconvenience on yourself to some extent.
I guess.
Because you can see from their perspective, well, if that was me, I would like, you know, I would need help or I would need me.
Sure. I understand the point that you're making, but I think that everything in life requires balance. And you have to be balanced in the way that you help other people. So if you're helping other people and at the same time hurting yourself,
no, I'm not saying you're doing it to the point of being.
I understand. I'm just taking your example to an extreme.
Okay.
So you might be late for what? For yourself, okay, so no big deal because you run your own schedule. But if you're late for a doctor's appointment, that means you're keeping the doctor waiting and everyone who's in line behind you waiting. Mm-hmm. So when you think about the big picture, it may or may not be the right thing to do, and that's really a challenge in figuring out in the day-to-day life, you know, and how to maintain balance. That's a challenge. Okay. The Ramban is a early commentator on Chumash, on the Torah itself, And he says that it's impossible to love other people as much as you love yourself. It's just not realistic. It's not. God doesn't really expect you to love other people as much as you love yourself, even though Cindy is giving a fairly appropriate answer for how it's possible to, at least at times, be caring for other people as much as you would care for yourself. You know, the quote-unquote, the golden rule, you know, do unto others as you would want to have being done unto yourself. That's true. But kamocha, really.
Isn't the Jewish way the opposite of that? Do not do unto others as you
there are two. There are the answer to that is that there are two sayings, one by Rabbi Akiva, one by Hillel. They both said the same thing, one in the inverse and one in the opposite.
I didn't know they were both Jewish.
Yeah. Okay. The Ramban poses a different question, which is maybe something that was touched on, but it's a very important question when dealing with this issue of how is it possible to love other people as much as you love yourself. And he says, no, it's impossible to really love others as much as you love yourself. By the way, just to remind you, there is plenty of food here. It's light food, but if anybody's interested, please don't be shy. It's here. It's meant to be eaten. And let's do that. Okay. So,
love yourself.
Yeah. It's a mitzvah if you aren't full. It's a mitzvah if it's healthy. It's a mitzvah if it's taking care of yourself. If you're struggling with, you're part of OEA, and things like that, well, that's something else. Okay. So the Ramban writes as follows. I'm going to read it to you in Hebrew, if I may, and then I'll translate it into English and then make a comment on what he writes. He says, there are times when a person loves another person in well-known ways. To do good to him through his wealth. However, he withholds his chachma, he withholds his wisdom. In other words, if I have another person, a friend of mine, who I'm supposed to love, like I love myself, so he needs a favor, so I'll do him a favor, but I'm going to limit that favor. And we'll see in a moment why I'm limiting the favor. He needs money, he needs some capital to go invest in a business, and I have the wherewithal to help him out in that regard, so I can do that. But when it comes to chachma, when it comes to wisdom, I'm going to withhold and not share wisdom with him. I'm not going to give him good advice. He writes that if I truly loved him the way I was meant to, so then I want him to have everything that I have. However, he says the challenge is like this. Basically, our very nature is to be egocentric or to be egotistical. We want to be on top. We live in a competitive world. We live in a world of the market and business, and we want to do better than other people are doing. Correct? If you mentioned it earlier, I have a competitor.
The cliche is, you know, oh, my son is there, my daughter is there, yeah. You know, or my grandson, right? Mine goes to Harvard, mine goes to Yale.
Yeah, and even that's already, you know, nachas in terms of taking pride in your children and your grandchildren. But just we live in a very
negative.
I understand. We live in a capitalistic society, and the nature of a capitalistic society is that if I'm in a certain business, let's say I'm in the garment business, right? So, do I want my competitors to succeed?
No.
And even if I have a really good heart, and there's enough business for the both of us, okay, do I want him to succeed as much as I succeed, or do I want to at least be one level up above him? That's human nature, at least in today's world. Human nature is I want to be better than the other person. So if that, and Ramban writes, that's the challenge in loving other people kamocha, in loving other people as much as you love yourself. Because even if somebody who you really truly love, a friend of yours, a close friend, someone you've known for 35 years, and they're doing very well, but you want your house to be a little bit bigger, your car to be a little bit nicer, your children to be a little bit more successful. You know, if they go to Berkeley and Stanford, well, if your kids go to Stanford, you want their kids to go to Berkeley. No offense. Oh, he walked out. Yeah. Yeah. It's the keeping up with the Joneses, except wanting to be better than the Joneses syndrome. Well, I'll get to you in one second, please. So the Ramban says that what the Torah demands from us is to take that level of jealousy or potential jealousy out of our hearts and want goodness for other people as much as we want it for ourselves. Because ultimately, what am I losing by him being just as successful as I am? Nothing. Again, it assumes that there's enough market to go around for everybody, right? But what am I losing by somebody else being successful? I'm not losing anything. So the Ramban says, V'hafal recha kamocha, is that you should want other people to be as successful as you are yourself.
That's not necessarily true, the statement that you have nothing to lose, because that assumes the relationship with your flesh. That means that once they get to this powerful position, that will also give you the same way.
Well, what if they don't though? What if they don't? Does that change what we expect what is expected from you?
Well, that means that you have an imposed risk on yourself that once they get into this position, they will use it to diminish you.
No, it's true. It's true that that'll be one of the challenges of it. So it doesn't make it any... I'm not saying this is easy. I'm just saying that this is possible.
You said, what do you have to lose? I think there is something to lose. I mean, we might be, you know, a price worth paying, but I mean, there is something to lose. But then...
Yeah, when I said what do you have to lose, I think I meant from a financial standpoint or from a wisdom standpoint. You're saying from a psycho-emotional standpoint, I can theoretically become a person that gets beaten down, right?
Well, if it's a business, there isn't enough market for everyone, and even you allow the other person to also succeed, once he's in a successful state, he might want to take it.
Yeah, so again, it's like everything else in life. The only person you can control in life is yourself, you know? What are you going to do about it? That's not much you can do about it. Yeah.
I don't think this will apply to businesses, because if you will love your partner, it means that you will fail. So when you love, your energy goes to a different level, you become like more relaxed, and you don't perform, you're like, okay, you're very quiet. But when you want to succeed, and when you really hate them, that's how the different energy and spark of some different ideas will come, and so you will be succeeded.
Are you suggesting that you have to hate your partner to be successful?
It's not the hate. I don't know how to phrase it. It's very hard. But I know that there was a very famous conductor, my friend, when I used to be in Russia, and he said, you have to come on stage hungry. You don't eat whole day, and you have to be very angry. If you're very peaceful and loving, you will not perform. You will not give that special moment to the audience. That's why I don't really agree that you have to love your business partner. I mean, you have to respect them, and you have to follow the rules.
Again, we're just...
But you don't have to really love him.
Yeah, so I think the word love, again, we still haven't defined yet. But all Ramban is saying is whatever love is, or even forgetting for a moment the word love, but v'ahavta, the commandment is that you want other people to be as successful as you are. So even in, take your case. So I don't know if some of you know that I'm a singer. I'm dying for other people to sing as well as I do. Because then we could sing together and we could put on more beautiful music. I don't have to be better than the other guy. I mean, maybe when it comes to my bottom line...
That's why you're not the Pavarotti. You know? I used to work in theater, and actually...
I will tell you...
You have to go through...
I am aware that Chazanim, right? Yeah. Chazanim, cantors have the... When you talk about ego, right? When you talk about ego and celebrities, and you talk about ego, there's no question they are not fulfilling the words of the Ramban. I agree.
That's the point.
They do, because they give a lot of pleasure to people, millions. They give a lot of pleasure.
In this very narrow definition of love, they are not, because they want to be better. They need to be better than the other person. But I'm not judging them. I'm just saying it's one of the struggles that they deal with. I promised you I'd answer your question. Okay.
Not a question. It's a teeny story. In Israel, there was a man who was really, really struggling, and he was a Yid, and there was another man who had he sold books. And whatever this other person did, he failed and failed. And the man said, I'll tell you what, there's a place across the street, we'll set you up to sell books, and I'll give you books. And so I think sometimes sometimes it's not that way. Sometimes someone says, you know what, we can, Hashem is big enough this world for both of us, mm-hmm. And you know, they, and then they were all appalled that this person was, setting up across the street like that, and they see him bringing books over to him, and then they realize, you know, that he was part of the plan.
Sure.
You know, so I don't think it has to be that way. I think that you can open your heart and
you want other people to be as successful as you are. Okay.
Right.
Last comment, and then I want to move on.
Okay. I just have to respond to that in that. The kind of joyful energy you get in cooperation and the kind of stimulation you get when you're working together with someone only snowballs for good. I don't believe you have to have anger and there has to be a power struggle for wonderful things to happen.
Unless
and to be successful.
Unless you get a promotion and you know. Unless I'm going to go back to what she said. And I think that that's the reality. And that's a great example. That's the world we really live in.
But I would hate to wake up in the morning and live my day like that. I rather expect the opposite.
I'm not
and so,
with you.
Yeah.
But that's not the reality that we live.
The Ramban is talking about the ideal. The ideal is the highest level that a person can attain that's human, that's possible, and that may or may not lead you to the highest level of performance. But that's not necessarily what God wants from you, per se. And what the audience gets out from it, you know, may or may not be relevant. But the point is that if I want other people to be as successful as I am, and I truly desire that, that would be a fulfillment of the mitzvah of Ve'ahavta l'Rechah Kamocha, loving other people as much as you love yourself. I'd like to just move on, because, like, as I mentioned, we could talk about everything for forever. So I mentioned that I'm a therapist, and one of the things that we do in therapy is we give exercises. Right? And so if you want to work on something, so you can exercise it in a safe environment, practice it in a way that's in a way that's meaningful, then hopefully will translate into real life. Being truly happy with somebody else's success does not mean that you have to be a doormat that you get walked all over. That's not what we're talking about. But if you're in a position to be truly happy for someone else's joy, and as you mentioned, that full feeling that you get, sometimes it's even better than the feeling that you have something for your own joy. Somebody's yearning for something, for a baby. And they're married for 12 years, and they've gone through everything. Hormonal treatment, IVF, they've done everything. And finally they have a healthy baby born to them after 12 years of marriage. How happy are you for that person?
It's good.
So, obviously, it gets complicated if, God forbid, you're that person who doesn't have the baby and they're having the baby, right? It gets more complicated. It gets much more difficult, right? Obviously. But, it reminds me recently of a friend of mine, or somebody who I know was dating for a number of years. You may be familiar with that in the Orthodox circles. So, there's a certain amount of pressure on the young people to get married. So I got married at 23, 7 years ago, and we have, Kanai Nahara, 4 beautiful daughters. But I have friends of mine who are not married yet. And they would love to be in my shoes. And it's very, very, it's difficult for them, it's very difficult for their parents. So a friend of mine's sister got engaged, and I think she was 27, which is 6 or 7 years past the time when she had wanted to be engaged, to get married. And I know this sounds like a foreign concept possibly, but just translate from 35 to 41, okay? And somebody else I know she wasn't really able to express her happiness for her because she herself has a daughter who is older than she would like to be. It's very difficult when you're in the same shoes to be happy for somebody else's success. It's easier when you're not. But let's go back to the example of having a baby. So obviously, I have 4 children. Baruch Hashem, thank God we don't have those challenges. And we pray that we continue not to have those challenges, because there is such a thing called secondary infertility, and some people they go through that later in time. But if you find out about somebody else's happiness, so what you can theoretically do is you stop, you pause, you consider how happy that person must feel, and then you enjoy it. You find out somebody got a promotion at work. Okay, so you could say, well, I've been stuck in the same job for so long and I haven't been promoted, and immediately turn it around onto yourself. You can do that. And we'll talk about narcissism in a moment. We'll talk about a very selfish viewpoint of the world in a moment. You can theoretically do that, but you can stop. Take a step back and think about how wonderful it must be for that person and for that person's family. Person makes a simcha. A baby is born. They make a bar mitzvah, a bat mitzvah, a wedding. The family is in a tremendous state of joy. If you stop, you pause, and you consider how happy that person must be, that is something that can fill you with a certain amount of joy, and that is a fulfillment of the mitzvah, at least according to the way the Ramban puts it, of enjoying other people's successes. And you can start simply, right? Because again, if you've been waiting for that promotion, well, you may not be ready to enjoy somebody else's promotion. But that same person or someone else has some joy in life. If you stop, you pause, and you consider, it really just takes a moment of thought about how wonderful it is for that person, and enjoy that person's simcha. Okay. This is really our first narrowing or first view and glimpse of what the Torah has to say about love. Let's move on to the second. This is Yerushalmi. You may not be familiar. There's a Talmud, Bavli. When we talk about the oral law, usually what we're talking about is the Mishnah and the Talmud. When we talk about Talmud, it usually means the Babylonian Talmud or Talmud Bavli. However, there's another Talmud that's lesser known called the Talmud Yerushalmi, which is the Talmud written in Jerusalem around the same time, give or take 30 or 40 years, that was codified 30 or 40 years, actually I think before the Babylonian Talmud. And the Yerushalmi says as follows. There's another mitzvah in the Torah which happens to be in Leviticus in the exact same place that the mitzvah of Ve'ahavta l'recha kamocha, loving other Jews as much as you love yourself, is. And that is lo tikom v'lo titor. Have we ever heard of that one? Which is do not take revenge. And the way they usually translate it is do not bear a grudge. Okay, so do not take revenge means, the example that Rashi, the foremost commentator on the Chumash, says is do not take revenge means that if somebody does not lend you their iPod, he says X. Okay. So revenge would be, well, when they want to borrow your iPod, so then you don't lend it to them. Okay, classic example. Bear grudge is where you tell the person, or at least in your mind internally, there's dialogue going on and saying, even though that person didn't give me the iPod, I'm going to give it to him nonetheless. It's because you still bear some sort of grudge towards that person for not having done you the favor. So rather, the Torah says, let go. Okay. So how is it possible not to take revenge? How is it possible not to hit back? How is it possible not to bear a grudge? So the Yerushalmi says, if you have a specific viewpoint and understanding of how the Jewish people relate to each other, so it will be easier. And the example that Yerushalmi says, imagine you're in the kitchen. So my wife does most of the cooking in our house, but I do most of the prepping. I do most of the peeling and the cutting. So imagine I'm in the kitchen on a Thursday night getting ready for Shabbat, and I accidentally cut myself. God forbid. I'm chopping onions and... You're peeling a carrot. This I've done. You're peeling a carrot and you accidentally peel part of your finger away or your nail away. It's painful, you know? So taking revenge would mean my left hand taking revenge on my right hand and making sure it's equal on both sides, right? Of course, that's ridiculous. Yeah. And then you keep going back and forth. Okay. So Israel, the Jewish people, in a very holistic and very Kabbalistic sense, is one body. And this is a famous idea, but now we're taking that idea and making it relevant for our question. And, you know, Roger and I, to each other, since we are both Jewish, we have souls that are related somehow or another. They're all part of one whole. And why would I want to take revenge on myself? When you think about being Jewish, and being Jewish means that all Jews have this special connection. It's what the Israelis in the mall trying to sell you the Dead Sea things. New mishpacha, 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 right? And they draw you in. And they say, we're family. And they're right. Doesn't mean you have to buy the product, but... They're absolutely correct. We are mishpacha, we are family, and we're all related to each other. In the same way you wouldn't, God forbid, take revenge on one of your children, or a brother, or a sister, and again, people that do, that's the exception to the rule. or yourself. So ideally, if you view Jewish people as a brother and as a sister, so then you're not going to want to take any revenge on them. And that's what the Yerushalmi suggests as an option. And Rav Dessler, the second source for our talk tonight is Rabbi Eliyahu Dessler, who was a great rabbi originally from Kelm in Lithuania, I believe. He spent a lot of time in England, and then he moved to Panovich in Bnei Brak in Israel, where he was Mashkiach, where he was the spiritual guide for the yeshiva. And he has a kuntras called the Kuntras HaChesed, which is the he has two titles in English, either the Book of Loving Kindness or Giving and Taking. It's all about giving and taking. And the second, he's the second source for most of the material of tonight's discussion. Okay. One of the questions that was mentioned earlier was people you don't know. Okay? So, Rav Dessler writes, I mean, obviously that Abbas Yisrael, the love of the Jewish people, demands that it doesn't really matter whether or not you love them. And there's a fascinating story that I'll share with you in a moment about that idea. But Rav Dessler writes that you know what, let me share the story, and then we'll use Rav Dessler's definition of love, and then we can answer that question. Sorry for going out of order here. Okay, so there's a great story with Rav Meir Shapiro. Have you ever heard of Dreyfus? The blood libel. Okay, so the famous Dreyfus case, what, 1911? Something like 1914? Somewhere around there. In Russia, where they accused him of one of the most famous accusations against the Jewish people for the last 3,000 years or so, and that is that we used Christian blood in the baking of the matzahs. And this guy, apparently, who, by the way, was not a religious or observant Jew at all, if my memory is correct, and they accused him of using Christian blood, or killing a Christian child and then using the blood in the baking of the matzah, which is ludicrous and obviously is false. But as is often the case,
what? Isn't somebody in France who was accused of spying?
Yeah. So maybe I'm mixing up names then.
I'm wondering if you're confusing the three stories.
Maybe I'm confusing the name, but there was a you're right.
In the Franco-Prussian War, there was somebody accused of spying, aiding the Prussians, who was
Thank you, Martin. So it's not Dreyfus, it's a different case, also a very famous case, from the 20th century, which is unusual to have a blood libel in the 20th century. If I recall who it is, I will let you know. Pardon? In Atlanta? Well, it comes up every so often. The case I'm referring to happened in Russia.
Well, there was somebody executed in Atlanta.
That's not the case I'm referring to.
It's another story.
Yeah. Anyways,
there's so many
of them. Yeah. Raping somebody.
Okay. Anyways, the point of the story here is nothing really to do with who it was or where it was, but the point is that in the trial, rather than putting the person on trial, they put the Torah on trial. And one of the questions that the prosecutor asked the defense to prove that that Jewish people consider themselves elite and non-Jewish people subhuman, which of course is false, is that the Torah says, and it comes in from a parsha from 2 weeks ago, is Adam ki yamut ba'ohel, man when he dies in a tent. And the Gemara says ki atem, that there's a level of spiritual impurity, all the details are not so important, that applies to coming into contact with a dead body, and this applies only, the Talmud teaches only to a Jewish corpse and not to a non-Jewish corpse. The Gemara says, "Ki atem kruyin Adam ve'ein akum kruyin Adam," which means that only Jewish people are called Adam. Okay, so it's, on the surface, it is damning. You know, it does seem very, very strong that only Jewish people are considered human, and it's a difficult one to deal with. The Gemara, though, so they asked this question and they sent this question out to various rabbis throughout Eastern Europe. Rav Meir Shapiro of Lublin, have you ever heard of the Daf Yomi?
Yeah.
Where they learn a page of Gemara every single day. Rav Meir Shapiro was the one who instituted the Daf Yomi. And he said, the best way to deal with this question, and it's a very true and accurate way, and it's really very beautiful if you think about it, is what happens when you have a non-Jewish person die, God forbid, in Brazil? Okay? A missionary dies in Brazil. A person, somebody in the Amazon who's been dedicating their life to bringing the word of etc. to to the people in the Amazon. And at the same time, you have another person, another missionary, who is doing his mission somewhere in the Sahara Desert. And they read on Google News, which they check 18 times a day, they read about this person that died in the Amazon. What kind of feelings do they have for that person? They may or may not have any feelings. I can't tell you for sure. But we don't expect them to have any feeling. And maybe it's for the reason that Cindy suggested earlier, which is you have to lead your life and you got to compartmentalize and just move on. However, God forbid there's a terrorist attack in Jerusalem and a bunch of Jews die. What happens? At the very least, we have a moment of passion, a moment of sympathy, a moment of feeling bad for those Jews in Israel that have died. Why is that? He says, because all Jews are one mishpacha, we're all one family, we're all related to each other, and we're all connected in a very, very spiritual and very, very deep way, so that when one Jew is impacted, I'm impacted as well. And that's why it says Adam, as opposed to Anashim. Adam is in the singular. As you may be aware, in Hebrew there's a difference between singular and plural in the way that words are written. So the way that you say one man is Adam, the way that you say two men is Anashim, two men. There's no plural for Adam, as far as I'm aware. And this is really, it just brings out the same idea, and that is that there is this deep love that we should theoretically have for each other. That the Ramban says, just to reiterate, the Ramban says that you're not going, that you want to have other people be as successful as you are. And the Yerushalmi said that why would you want to take revenge on somebody who's your own family or your own body? Okay. So let's get to the actual definition of love, and then we'll apply it to. We're going to move on to spouse in a moment, okay? In the time that we have remaining. Reb Dessler says, if you take a look at the board on the left, it says, V'ahavta, and you shall love. The root of the word V'ahavta is hav, which means to give. Hav is an Aramaic word. Whether or not it's actually the root or just a very strong relationship between the two, I'm not sure. But Rav Dessler says there's a very strong connection between the word v'ahavta and ha, which is to love. Yeah, very good. Yeah, okay. So Rav Dessler. Here we go, okay. Rav Dessler also quotes from Derech Eretz Zuta to prove this point. Derech Eretz Zuta is the Talmud, where it says, in English, I have it here in Hebrew as well somewhere, but it says in English that if you want to keep close to the love of your friend, meaning if you want to fulfill loving your friend, how do you go about loving other people? Again, the word love, whatever that means, okay? But how do you go about loving other people from the Torah's perspective? Make it your concern to seek his welfare. Make it your concern to seek other people's welfare. And how do you go about doing that? By giving to them. Okay. So Rav Dessler writes, so again, the definition or the working definition that we're using for love, beyond just loving other people as much as you love yourself, is that it's through the process of giving that you come to love. I can't remember whether or not it's John Gray or Stephen Covey, two very popular authors of pop psychology. John Gray wrote Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. And Stephen Covey wrote The Seven Habits of
Effective Happy.
There you go. Okay. So he came, a couple walked in to him, and or one of, I can't remember which one it was, but a couple walked in, and they said, well, we're no longer in love. We've fallen out of love. When we got married, we were so in love. And that love has sustained us thus far, but we're no longer in love, so we want to get a divorce, but we decided we'll try counseling first. So he said to them, I don't understand. You're not in love? It's a very easy solution to that. He turns to the man, he says, love your wife. And he turns to the woman, and she says, love your husband. He says, no, you didn't understand us. We're speaking English to you. We are no longer in love. He says, I know, I heard you say you're no longer in love. All you have to do is love your spouse. What's he talking about? And the answer, of course, is, and he has a whole elaboration on this. This is it comes from a Jewish source originally. But the answer is, if you give to someone, you will love them. If you give to them, you will generate feelings of love for them inside of yourself.
It's still from coffee.
It is cooked? Okay, good. All right. Usually when you get a shir and you're not sure where something is in Chumash or Gemara, so you'll have somebody there who might tell you where it is. But this is good. Wow, okay. Okay, so Rav Dessler writes, if one were only to reflect that a person comes to love the one to whom he gives, he would realize, and here's where he answers that question about, you know, what if you don't know them? He would realize that the only reason the other person seems a stranger to him is because he has not yet given to him. He has not taken the trouble to show him friendly concern. If I give to someone, I feel close to him. I have a share in his being. It follows that if I were to start bestowing good upon everyone I come into contact with, obviously if they're living somewhere else, it's not relevant, right? But if with everyone with whom you come in contact, you know, let's say you attend a synagogue, you attend a shul, you attend a community center. So if you're a little introverted, so you may not go and welcome the other person who you don't recognize. If you're a little more extroverted, you might. Or if you're on the committee that says who does what, so okay, and all that kind of wonderful things where the shuls have these kinds of things organized. But if you can get out of your shell and welcome somebody, so then all of a sudden you're connected to them. And what have you given to them? You've given to them of yourself. Giving to them doesn't mean that you give them a dollar or you give them a piece of cake or a drink. It can mean those things as well. If I were to start bestowing good upon everyone I come into contact with, I would soon feel that they were all my relatives, all my loved ones. I now share in them all. My being has extended into all of them. The word, v'ahavta, so yahav means to give. You're giving something from yourself. As we mentioned earlier from Eric Fromm, when you respect yourself, when you don't judge yourself poorly, when you, what were the words we used? When you knew yourself and you were realistic and honest about your strengths and your weaknesses, so when you act like that towards other people, so then you will generate feelings of love for them.
It's not that simple. People give reasons that have nothing to do with love.
Yes.
They give to people to control them. They give to people to feel better than they are. They give to people to create a sense of obligation. There are all sorts of very non-loving reasons why people give.
Mm-hmm. That's
so
not truly giving,
though.
That falls outside the definition.
Okay, so Roger is answering.
You know, the classic, I've given you everything.
That's a manipulative give. It's not giving.
Exactly.
Okay, good.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what we're talking about is the sort of giving that comes from a good place, not necessarily the giving that comes from I'm giving you in order to control, is you owe me a favor or anything like that. Okay.
The golden ladder.
What's that?
Like the golden ladder.
What's the golden ladder?
Charity, Maimonides.
Oh, yeah.
Golden.
Okay.
It's got the steps of.
Yeah. And it can often be, you know, you might feel great about it, but then what about the other person? Because receiving can be very problematic.
Yes. Right. So again, if you're talking about financial gifts, or even,
it doesn't have to be financial. It could be other things like time or attention. It's trickier than a straightforward, if you give to people, then you know,
sure.
That's how you love them.
Absolutely. No, but again, it goes back to the point I made earlier, which is that you have to make sure that your giving is something that the person needs or wants or desires. If the person doesn't want any contact with you, what are you going to do? You can't help that. Right? But if you give a listening ear, you give a compassionate, empathic conversation where they just talk and all you do is listen. That's giving. You can find some way to give. I mean, there's a. I can say it here very easily. I once said this over when we were living in Baltimore and I got into trouble. I'll tell you in a moment why.
Baltimore?
I used to live in Baltimore.
From there. What's your last name?
Stewart. We'll play Jewish geography later.
Your brother?
No. We'll play Jewish geography afterwards. Okay. My wife was working for a school, and it was a complicated relationship between the administration of the school, and she basically worked for an agency that was a special education agency that was housed in another school, where they provided the special education services for the homeschool. The homeschool's administration, or the secretaries working for the administration of the homeschool, had a very difficult time understanding the relationship and the connection, and they were very, very cold and standoffish. And so my wife and I had a conversation about, you know, what to do about this. What can you do about it? But we said that one of the things that you can do is, actually this story doesn't work so well, but I might as well finish it, I started it. One of the things that you can do is generate feelings of goodness in yourself and of liking the other person yourself, and then the other person will soften up a little bit. It's a pasuk in Mishlei. Perhaps those who are studying Mishlei with Rabbi Felsen have or Proverbs have reached this verse, which is Kamayim Panim El Panim Kain Lev Ha'adam. Is that the end of the rest of the pasuk? That just as water reflects water, so too hearts of man reflect the heart of man. So if you go into a meeting and you're concerned about the other person's negative attitude, so you have to go on with a great positive attitude, and then they will feed off of that somehow or another. So I told my wife, if you go in with that positive attitude, so that it will be reciprocated as well. The other thing I said you can do is you can bribe them and give them a very nice mishlach monon on Purim and give them a Hanukkah gift, because we are susceptible to that sort of a thing. I thought the story was going to work, but it doesn't work so well. Okay, anyways.
To a degree,
it did work. Now, the reason why I shouldn't have told her that story is because one of the secretaries was sitting there and didn't realize that she was actually in the room. So you talk about footing, you know, FIM, foot and mouth disease? Yeah. Okay. 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 Let's move on to the love of spouse. Okay. So as I mentioned earlier, the Talmud says, "Ha'oev es ishto ki gufo v'mechabe yoser mi gufo," that a person is supposed to love his wife as much as he loves his own body. And whatever exactly that means. And he's supposed to honor her more than he honors his own body. You know, the famous archetype of the irresponsible husband who leaves his socks lying around the floor because he doesn't mind. Right? We all know someone like that, maybe. Dirty laundry laying around. Things that women often complain about their husbands, things of that nature, because women would never do that. So a person say, well, I love my wife as much as I love myself. I'm not treating her any better than I would treat myself, because I don't mind it on the floor. And so the Gemara says you should love her as much as you love yourself, which means give to her as much as you give to yourself, according to our definition of love. But you should be mechabed, you should honor her more than you love yourself. You should honor her in the way that she would like to be honored, and not the way that you would like to be honored. Okay, so there's two challenges when it comes to loving your spouse. Considering the time, is it okay if we just do 15 more minutes? Are we all...
What is he saying?
Okay. If anybody has to leave, please feel free to leave. And I apologize if we... I guess that... Thank God it's interactive and the discussion has led us to this point. I'd rather do that than sit here and just lecture straight for an hour or so. It's much more interesting. It's much more interesting like this, at least for me and hopefully for everybody here as well. So, God willing, I said 8:45. Are you holding me to it?
No.
Okay.
But 9, eh?
Nine, right. Okay. My wife would appreciate it if I got home shortly after 9 as well. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so the biggest challenge is, I came up with two big challenges. One is one that Eugenia mentioned, and we'll get to that one second. Okay. But the first one that I mentioned, that I think, and I think it's important to talk about because it's really been touched on, is what we call selfishness. 90% of all conflicts in the workplace, according to a person, her name is Esther Kestenbaum, who is a consultant for a company that does a lot of... let's just say consulting work. I don't go into it too deeply, but mediation and conflict management and things of that nature. So she said that she told me that 90% of all conflicts in the workplace are the result of people being internally focused rather than being externally focused. Does anybody here work in a company? Does that resonate? Does that sound familiar? Okay. Rav Mati Berger, who is a rabbi at Eish HaTorah in Jerusalem, he once said the following statement. I mentioned earlier that here, you know, in traditional Orthodox circles, generally speaking, boys get married between ages of 22 and 26 is normal. Girls between the age of 19 and 23 is normal. And when they get engaged, so there's something called a vart. In Yiddish, what does the word vart mean? It means a word. So I'm not sure how this, why it's called a vart. But what's a vart? A vart is pretty much an engagement party. Low-key engagement party in the home of the bride, usually, of the kala. where the community comes to meet the groom and to celebrate the simcha, to they're practicing that, enjoying other people's happiness. So he says, what's a vart? A vart is a party between two selfish people. Because the reason that I'm going to engage to you is because you're the best person in the world for me. And the reason that you're going to engage to me is because I'm the best person in the world for you. And if I wasn't, then why would you want to be engaged to me? And if you weren't the best person for me, then why would I want to be engaged to you? So what's a vart? It's a party for two selfish people. It's a very cynical way of looking at it, but there's some truth to it if you think about it. In Fromm's writings, he spends a lot of time, and I'm not going to quote everything to you, but I'll quote enough of it because I think that one of the questions that I came up with in terms of loving other people is, what is the biggest inhibitor of loving other people properly? And the answer, I think, is, at least according to Fromm, is narcissism. That's a hard one for me to pronounce. Okay. He writes, the main condition for the achievement of love is the overcoming of one's narcissism. Okay, so let's just define that in case we're not familiar with the term. The narcissistic orientation is one in which one experiences as real only that which exists within oneself, while the phenomena in the outside world have no reality in themselves, but are experienced only from the viewpoint of their being useful or dangerous to one's own self. Again, we're talking about an extreme. There's a continuum here. I'm not either selfless or selfish. I'm not either narcissistic or giving and open and objective. I could be somewhere in between. We all have elements of this, and hopefully we all have elements of both parts to it. The opposite pole to narcissism is objectivity. It is the faculty to see people and things as they are, objectively, and to be able to separate this objective picture from a picture which is formed by one's desires and fears. He's a psychologist. He's writing, all forms of psychosis show the inability to be objective to an extreme degree. For the insane person, the only reality that exists is that within him, that of his fears and his desires. And he sees, okay. He writes an example, and I think it's great. For those of you who get my video, I used it in this past week's Dvar Torah. I send out a weekly Dvar Torah on the Parsha, some words of Torah. I do I try to keep it under 4 minutes. Usually I succeed, because people don't want to watch a video that's any longer than that. It's a great story. There's a woman who's a very narcissistic person. She calls up the doctor and says, "Doctor, I need an appointment this afternoon." And the doctor says, "I'm sorry to hear that you need an appointment. I don't have any time for you this afternoon. Can we set something up for tomorrow morning?" And she says, "Doctor, but I only live 5 minutes away." In other words, the fact that she does not take a lot of time is somehow going to save him time that he doesn't have. Right? If you think about that story, that is the ultimate narcissistic person. She is not at all considering him at all. It's just about her. Okay. What's that?
Unless that's a doctor.
Yeah, she needs a concierge. She needs a concierge doctor. That's what she needs, right? Yeah.
You know what? I think it really depends on why you need to go to the doctor. You know, because did you stub your toe, or you know, is your?
I once went to a doctor's office in Baltimore to Dr. Jacobowitz, and they said to him, "Downstairs, lady just fell and hit her head, and she's bleeding. Just call 911." There's protocol. There's order to the world. Right? And yet like I said, balance. Okay. So he writes, love being dependent on the relative absence of narcissism, it requires the development of humility, objectivity, and reason. He says one's whole life must be devoted to this aim. I must try to see the difference between my picture of a person and his behavior, as it is narcissistically distorted, and the person's reality as it exists, regardless of my interests, needs, and fears. The ability to love depends on one's capacity to emerge from narcissism, etc. Again, if you want to see the full quote, I highly recommend the book, The Art of Loving by Eric Fromm, where he has many, many paragraphs devoted to this topic. But that is, in a nutshell, what one must overcome when we're dealing with our wives, or when we're dealing with our spouses, or really anybody, but it's particularly true in those to whom we are closest, with whom we are closest. Okay. Let me just find my notes back again. Okay, here we go. So that is the challenge. And the same principles that we applied earlier to, in other words, giving and wanting them to be as successful as you are and understanding their family, those are principles that can help us overcome those challenges. The second challenge is, this is the one that Eugenia has been waiting for all night, and is the modern notion of falling in love. Let me see if I can quote directly from him, because he does a much better job than I could. Okay. He's talking about there are attitudes that there's nothing to be learned about love. And he says the assumption is that the problem of love is the problem of an object, not the problem of a faculty. People think that to love is simple, but to define the right object to love is difficult. Because, again, their whole definition of love is that it is something that's either there or it's not there. We're saying the exact opposite tonight. He says this attitude has several reasons rooted in the development of modern society. One reason is the great change which occurred in the 20th century with respect to the choice of a love object. In the Victorian age, as in many traditional cultures, love was mostly not a spontaneous personal experience, which then might lead to marriage. On the contrary, marriage was contracted by convention, either by the respective families or by a marriage broker. Or without the help of such intermediaries, it was concluded on the basis of social considerations. And love was supposed to develop once the marriage had been concluded. In the last, right, is that the world we live in today? Okay. In the last few generations, by the way, that is the, more or less, that is the Orthodox world. That's how it's supposed to be. You're not necessarily in love with your spouse when you marry them. You can marry them on paper because you have enough in common, because you have similar goals, and you have chemistry and you're attracted. And you have chemistry with them and you're attracted to them. I'm not talking about the Hasidic circles where they meet one or two times. I'm talking about where you're meeting 8 to 10 times for each one for a period of 4 to 6 hours where you're not bowling or watching a movie together, which happens to be what we call parallel play. That's what children do when they reach a certain age. But it's actually engaging in discussion, and it's a very, very intensive process. And it results in less divorces, much fewer divorces, than the secular world. Is it a perfect system? No, not by any means. But it is a better system. Okay. But again, if you haven't grown up with it, then it's really foreign. Okay. In the last few generations, the concept of romantic love has become almost universal in the Western world. And again, he's writing 1956. In the United States, while considerations of a conventional nature are not entirely absent, to a vast extent, people are in search of romantic love, of the personal experience of love, which should then lead to marriage. And he writes, that's why people conceive love as an object rather than as a function. It's something that happens rather than something that you perform or do. Okay. Every single book that you read that's a love story, or movie that you watch that's a love story, regardless of what you believe. Now, if I, by show of hands, do you really believe in the notion of romantic love as being a love that can sustain itself? Okay, no one's raising their hand. Why not?
Yeah, it's possible.
Of a notion of falling in love that can sustain itself only based on those principles.
Oh, you mean without anything?
Yeah.
Without anything but romantic?
Yes.
Oh, no. It evolves. One in a million.
Okay.
You need more than heaven.
Yeah. Okay. So I was just going to say like this.
But
that
you also need.
I didn't say that you
need. Yeah, no, absolutely. That's why I mentioned that's one of the points that's necessary.
I mean that you need chemistry. I just meant that chemistry alone is not going to make a difference.
Okay. So I wrote as follows, and I was just musing to myself. The definition of successful love in today's modern world is impossible. Let me ask you a question. What's the happiest day of your life? Your wedding? If that's the answer to the question, is a problem.
Okay.
I mean, that's people's instinctive response, but then they stop and they think, you know, that may be the most intense moment of happiness of my life, but it shouldn't necessarily be the happiest or best day of your life. Why? Because hopefully your relationship with your spouse or with your significant other, or with your etc., with anyone with whom you come in contact, has developed from that point in time where you are much closer today than you are, or than you were the day that you got married. And if the if the moment of most intense quote unquote love is the time that you got married, well, there's something wrong with that marriage. It means that you haven't developed and grown together. I was going to say, every book you read, every movie you watch that puts forth this notion of romantic love, it further hoodwinks you into believing in this stuff. And the challenge, and that's why it's a challenge. It's not just a challenge in terms of what the world says, but we heap this challenge upon ourselves. That's normal behavior for most people. So being aware of it is something that might be helpful. Okay. A chavrus of mine suggested as follows, and I think Cindy hinted at this. There's no allowance for phasing in today's notion of love. Phasing means that in this phase, you know, when my wife and I got married, we said, we'll never let things become routine.
Yeah.
We'll never let things become routine. I mean, routine is boring, and we want to have things exciting all the time. And of course, that's
4 kids later.
Yeah, right? And with every additional child, it becomes less and less routine, I guarantee it. Okay. But of course, the answer is routines are normal. That routines are normal and healthy. And there's phasing. And that means that at various phases in our life, we are connected in different ways. So just to quickly summarize, considering that it is 9 o'clock, that clock is a few minutes fast, at least I hope it is. Just to quickly summarize, what we're really talking about is the challenge. We define love as one can learn to love and be loving by giving. That is the Jewish concept of love. It's rooted in the very etymology of the word ahava, ha, which is to give. On top of that, the biggest challenge in loving other people as much as you love yourself is how can you love other people as much as you love yourself? It's not realistic. In fact, the Torah does not allow you to love people as much as you love yourself. Because the Torah says chayecha kodmim, which means that your life takes precedence. If you are in a desert and there is one flask of water, the Torah says, don't share it. Hold on to it. Your life is more valuable than anybody else's life. At the same time, of course, the Torah says that you have to give your own life up if the choice is to murder somebody else. Right? We're not talking about that. But chayecha kodmim, your own life takes precedence over anybody else's. But at the same time, you can still love other people as much as you love yourself in a certain sense, and that is, you want them to be as successful as you are, and if you view them as family, then it's possible to reach a level where they're not just your partner, they're not just somebody else in business and your competitor, but it's all mishpacha, it's all family. And then finally, we talked about the challenges in loving your spouse, and that is overcoming your narcissistic personality, overcoming your selfish egotism, your egocentric nature, where it's about you and making it more about the other person. And when you honor them more than yourself, that's one way of doing it. And just being aware of the challenge is half the battle, like many other areas of life. Just being aware that there is a challenge in overcoming your own subjectivity and trying to think about them more objectively. And that, of course, is a whole shir unto itself. How do you think about other people objectively? And then finally, fighting the notion of modern love and being aware that you really don't believe in it. So to expect that on an ongoing basis is just not being fair to yourself. And with that, we will end. I want to wish you a good evening and a wonderful week. Shavuot shalom.